Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program and registration information. I'm Congresswoman Jackie Speier, and today I'm your moderator for the program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Today, we will have a candid discussion with three combat veterans who turned to art after coming home from war. Together, their paintings, photographs, and a newly published novel form a vital conversation on the real costs of war, including the battles with PTSD, military sexual trauma, and the quest for a normal life. 2 years ago, I entered an elevator in my district office building in San Mateo. The door was about to shut when an arm was thrust in. It belonged to a young man who recognized me. He was an Iraq War veteran, and he had a lot to say about what the war did to him. I listened, and I will listen today to the three combat veterans. One of them, Ari Sonnenberg, an Army platoon sergeant who did three tours in Iraq, is why I have such a passion about the issues surrounding our veterans. When he was in the VA hospital, I took his wife, Patty, who is here in the audience. Where's Patty? Why don't you stand up so we can all see you? I took her to the VA office in Oakland because I wanted the director to see what his agency was doing to the family of a man who had served our country with honor and who now faced numerous surgeries to regain his life. But the VA was not approving his injury-related benefits. Well, the benefits were approved the next day. An oversight? It's more than that. It was an affront to all veterans who have risked their lives for our freedom. Fortunately, the Oakland VA Benefits Office has since improved its efforts to compensate veterans, but it has a long way to go. Now, you can argue about the wisdom of our country acting as a global police force. I certainly believe we have gone too far too often. I would say that the veterans on stage will speak to that matter shortly. But make no mistake about it, our country needs to listen and understand more about what combat veterans go through and how, like our veterans on the stage, they protect each other in battle. The dynamic of serving in combat together is not waving the flag and speaking of freedom. When I went to Afghanistan in 2010, I heard firsthand from people there. They did not want us in their land, and they were not interested in what we called freedom. Translated further, we don't need boots on the ground in places like Syria. What we need instead is a public discussion about the costs of boots on the ground, with special emphasis on the price paid by our men and women in combat. We have to do more than say, "Thank you for your service," when they come home. Simply put, they deserve understanding, they deserve jobs, they deserve a support system, they do not need lip service. I wasn't sure we could fill this room today. Combat is an uncomfortable subject, but I'm glad that all of you are here and that we enjoy the freedom to hear three veterans talk about their experiences in battle, their art, and their hopes for the future. Now it's my pleasure to introduce to you today's panelists. Michelle Wilmot served as a medic and mental health sergeant in the U.S. Army for 8 years. Since returning from military service in Iraq in late 2005, she has taken to fine art and creative writing to assuage post-war trauma. While on deployment in Ramadi, in 2004 to 2005, she served as a member of the, quote, Team Lioness, unquote, the first female team that was attached to Marine infantry units to perform checkpoint operations, house raids, and personnel searches on Iraqi women and children for weapons and explosives. She was featured in the 2008 documentary film Lioness and in several books covering women in combat. She is the author of Quixote in Ramadi, an indigenous account of imperialism, as well as the Women Warriors chapter of the book War Trauma and Its Wake. Drew Mendelson served as an artillery observer and liaison officer in Vietnam, attached to an infantry company, Bravo Company, 11th Brigade, American Division. Song Ba Tho is his first novel about the Vietnam War, based on his experiences from August 1969 to August 1970. He was based in the jungles and mountains of the Central Highlands with an infantry company, and then in those same mountains as a forward fire base called San Juan Hill. His second Vietnam War novel, A Shepherd to Fools, is in progress, hopefully its first draft to be finished at the end of the year. He says that many he served with never truly came home from the war. He says the parts of their bodies, parts of their souls, and parts of their sanity were left in country. He suffers a bit from PTSD, though he also counts himself fortunate that he has had a good life, a home, a family, and a worthwhile career. Ari Sonnenberg was an Iraq platoon sergeant known for taking on tough assignments. He saw heavy combat during three separate tours and also fought in Kosovo, Bosnia, and Macedonia. He left the Army in March 2009 with a traumatic brain injury and internal injuries that ultimately required surgery. Ari says his ambush evasion skills are as strong as ever, though it's the other coping skills, marriage, employment, sleeping, that remain a challenge. He's turned to artistic expression to help him. Ari enlisted in the Army in 1994 at the age of 17 to escape a rough neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York. He now paints scenes related to his combat experiences in addition to maintaining a website. Please welcome all of our panelists. All right, Ari, let's begin with you.
Good afternoon, Congresswoman and guests. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. It's actually quite amazing that the Congresswoman has really made such an effort to bring the struggle of veterans to the forefront of our society, when about 1% of the country has actually served in the military, give or take. We're actually the minority in the country, which has the lowest voice, and you don't really hear about us unless it's something bad in the news. So this event is quite amazing. Hopefully it'll start other events all over the United States, like the VA Fix-It event we did that's now kind of working its way through the system. But not everybody was so happy about our little event here. This was posted on the Congresswoman's Facebook wall, specifically towards me, which I thought was kind of comical. It says, "I'm sorry, what freedom is he talking about? The Iraq War never had anything to do with freedom. The sergeant is a participant in a horrible crime, the destruction of Iraq." This was said by David Spiro, a resident nurse here in San Francisco. So I like this comment a lot, because this is the culture and the opinions that are still directed at service members. My guess is this gentleman didn't really raise a hand of objection when his elected officials decided to approve the war. So I hope that he asks his representative if he voted yes to the war, and if so, hold him accountable. It's easy for other people that have never served to actually judge me or judge other members of this panel or of the military if you've never had the experience. But this shows also how the American society is quick to blame the veterans, like we voted to go to war, and not hold politicians accountable for the actions that they voted on. It actually shows what little respect that is given to us for our sacrifices. So the wonderful quality of our country is that we take so many things for granted. Waking up in a nice bed. I'm still sleeping on a little futon that's hard as anything. We take it for granted our morning coffee, just going out to the coffee shop, just going and watching movies, or even sleeping soundly at night in a false sense of security. For me, that world doesn't exist. I joined the military at 17, and I was raised by wolves, basically. You know, I learned all my values, all my morals, all my skills, everything I needed to stay alive, I learned in 14 years and kept me alive during all these combat tours. And it's funny because now all those skills are now being told to me they're all wrong, right? Here in the civilian world, if you communicate loudly, you're being called aggressive, right? If you're always watchful and you're always making sure you're sitting with the back to the door, you're hypervigilant. Every skill that I've learned in 14 years is now being told to me it's all wrong. Basically, my whole way of life now is being turned upside down, and I'm being told that you can't be in this world with these kind of skills, that it just doesn't work out. So I have a TBI, so I have to keep on going in my notes because I'll forget everything. So, you know, in this country, we talk a lot about sacrifice, and we talk a lot about what we give up. And in a country where we hold sports players as heroes who get paid millions of dollars to complain about they're not getting paid enough to feed their kids, you know, I think it's pretty funny how this is the sacrifice that our society has now deemed honorable, right? But what about the sacrifice of those that are left behind? Not just the veterans, but the sacrifice of their family members. Specifically, I can talk about my son. I didn't meet my son until he was 6. I was either deployed. I spent almost my full 14 years deployed to almost 9 or 10 years out of 14 deployed. I didn't meet my son because I volunteered for all my deployments because soldiers deserve good leadership, and I knew I was a good leader. And because of what happened to me in the war, I couldn't even go near him because I was scared he was going to blow up or he was a little Iraqi child. So my son sacrificed having a father, and he still does to this day because I can't interact with him the way I would like to. He asks me about the war, and I just kind of blow him off. Or he's lucky, he's only a little kid, so I can just give him a toy and just, you know, keep him satisfied. But he has asked questions like, have you killed anybody? Why are you always crying? I think I gave one painting to the congresswoman for her office that says that, actually. He doesn't understand, so this is real sacrifice. So when we hear about combat, we hear about war, we just hear about the deficit, or money-wise, it costs so much money to operate in Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam, or we just hear dollar and cents. We don't actually hear about the families that feel hopeless, like my wife. You know, she's been through everything. She's seen me sad all the time. She's seen me go through suicide attempts. She's seen me struggle to be in this world, to not even be able to have a relationship because I just cannot open up to people. The world is different for me. It's never going to be the same. The world will never be a place of unicorns and rainbows for me. You know, it's going to be a world of danger and death where at every step, I'm worried that if something's going to explode or somebody's going to shoot me, you know. So I would just like to say one last thing, and that's I'm not an artist, not in some fake introspective way, you know, how some people wear the funny hat and they're like, I'm an artist and I do such artwork and stuff like this. I'm not that at all. I don't pretend to be an artist. I don't even have like cards to give people. I'm not an artist, you know. I'm just a simple guy trying to do my best to survive in this world, to take each day at a time, to make the best sense of this world. I look at this world through distorted eyes, and believe me when I tell you, I would give anything to see this world for the beauty that it actually is. I would give anything to be able to appreciate those that are close to me, to be able to feel a connection with my son or a connection with other people. That world just doesn't exist for me. So that my art outside is not about, it's not about pretty colors or cool shapes. Most of the stuff looks like a fourth grader drew it, but I'm happy with it. It's about, it's my life. It's not about trying to make money. It's just about trying to express what's going on inside my head and how so many years of being in combat has affected my view on everything and everyone, and how that finally the silent minority in the country needs to have a voice, and how the silent minority, more leaders need to step up and they need to listen to what we have to say, and then maybe there won't be these unnecessary conflicts anymore. There won't be another generation's Vietnam. This is my Vietnam for my generation. So I'm hoping that by my art, because I only started painting about a year and a half ago when I was in the hospital. They make you do all these little fun things. And I just think that we need to actually bring a dialogue and hold elected officials and hold them responsible for what they've done to this country as far as the citizens and also what they've done to the veterans.
And thank you, Ari.
That's it.
Okay. Drew Mendelson.
First, I want to thank you, Congresswoman Speer, for your wonderful dedication to veterans and for the efforts that you've done on behalf of Ari and for even those of us from much earlier wars. I'd also like to thank the Commonwealth Club for putting this program on. I think it's amazing and truly appreciated by a lot of people who have served their country. You know, my war was a long time ago. It was Vietnam. In a way, it's been passé to talk about that because there's much newer issues. But I think if you ask any veteran, as far back as those still alive, as far back as the Second World War or the Korean War, you will realize that all of our experiences were much the same. The traumas we suffered were very much like those today. And as I was saying to someone outside earlier in the hall, it's probably the same if you talk to somebody who fought in the Roman Wars 2,000 years ago. They'd be complaining about this centurion or that bad sword that never got sharp, or the bad food, or, you know, when we got to Gaul, no one had a good place to sleep. We slept in the mud. It was the same. I'm very sure of that. The novel that brought me here is Song Bat Tho. Song means river in Vietnamese, and Bat Tho was the name of the river. The infantry company I was attached to as artillery forward observer worked primarily along that river. It's in the southern part of what was then called I Corps, which was the northern fourth of the U.S. military divisions in Vietnam. It we were in the Central Highlands. We were in the mountains and jungles. And in fact, we were perfectly happy to be jungle warriors. We got nervous when we went out into the plains areas where the rice paddies were and the flats along the coast, because there were people there. We were in what was called a free fire zone, which meant that nobody that was there was friendly, and you could shoot at anybody and needed no permission. If you were in the coastal areas, you actually had to call in and say, we see some enemy, can we shoot at them? We didn't have that problem, but it was even more, in some ways, more terrifying because of where we were. Almost all of the book really grows out of my own war experiences, stories I had to tell of friends and comrades in arms, stories which were really not pretty, men killed by snipers, booby traps, and enemy mortars, men who drowned in monsoon-swollen rivers, done in by friendly fire. My own radio operator was badly wounded when we were strafed accidentally by our own helicopter gunships who had mistaken us from the enemy. My own steel helmet was knocked off my head, and there was a scar on it where one of the machine gun bullets passed an inch from my head. If it had passed a little further, I wouldn't be here. The last third of the novel is really mostly set in one night and drawn from the worst battle that I was in, a 12-hour nightmare where the 95-man infantry company I was attached to was attacked and overrun by an entire battalion of more than 400 North Vietnamese, and we ended up fighting foxhole to foxhole, virtually isolated from each other for hours and hours before we finally pulled together and forced the enemy out of our perimeter. We counted 29 bodies of enemy soldiers inside our perimeter the next morning, and the intelligence that we got later on told us that we had virtually destroyed this entire North Vietnamese infantry battalion that had attacked us. When I came, as we would call it, back to the world, I really still knew the faces of the people that I served with, and over the 40 years plus subsequent, the faces in some ways have faded, but the memories of what happened remain very real. In the book, I ask, this was actually the excerpt that I enjoyed, the fact that the Chronicle ran in their piece about us last weekend. In the book, I ask where some of those people are. Where is Slate, the machine gunner who walked shotgun for 1-0, pure heart, dark eye, bedeviled smile of even white, and Pappy Valdez? He disappeared in battle where the Song Bateau and the Song Trinneau, swollen in the November monsoons, rushed together in a valley of the central highlands. Leon drowned, took a wrong step into the rushing Song Vei, and the black water swallowed him, leaving only a steel pot bobbing in it. Where are Darby Smith and Doc Dennis, they who reached for the stars as they saw the stars to be, bright points of bright hope infinitely far, who reached not far enough and came undone to soak into the red brick clay of that faraway peak? Where are Gaylord and Mexican Bill, souls so simple, smiles so mild, back in the world? Their real names are on the wall, and someone knows them. Someone pokes flowers in the cracks next to their names and weeps. And if I knew his name in the world, could I find Hungry on the wall, or Korski, or Red, or the Sundance Kid? Who of them survived? Who of them came back to the world? Who crept down into the soil of Quang Nai Province, into the gap-toothed circles of holes in Vietnam's orange dirt, among the litter of old French mines and bungee stakes, the dud artillery and mortar rounds? Who crept down among the shell fragments and the war's litter among the bones and pulled the soil over themselves like a blanket for their sleep? And then let me give you just one more brief excerpt. We hit a hilltop, and in the process of clearing it to set up our base for the night, our what we called a night, an NDP or night defensive position, one of them walked into a little wooded area and tripped a tripwire of a booby trap that the Viet Cong had left, and instantaneously 12 men were just destroyed, completely killed. Hey man, watch, a flash and shock and a tremendous report. The booby trap's fragments shred the scrubby bushes and churn the earth beneath them. The shock punches the air out of me and knocks me backwards, unseen. Things flash by, humming in their flight. One plucks at my pant leg, another sings viciously off my helmet and whizzes away. In my ears, the detonation bleeds away into silence, and then a ringing that fades into a rising discord of human screams. The blast's ghostly force has snatched Mexican Bill away, overcoming gravity's moment and throwing him back to the edge of the hill, where he lies loosely, broken, past any repair. The rest of the squad, who are closer than Mexican Bill to the point of the detonation, lie disassembled where the explosion has slapped them down. I scramble up from where the blast has smacked me. Captain Jack Sisko and I begin to run to them, Sisko wailing and charging toward where his friend Mexican Bill lies, calling out as he runs, Ciudadano Vato, Valgame Dios. In front of me, the squad leader is dying. Half his face and one arm are gone, and kneeling over him, I can't stop the bleeding. I think that what people should really be aware is that for those of us who served, no matter how long it was ago or no matter how recent, like Ari and Michelle, the memories overwhelm you at times, and the issues are as fresh as they were a long ago. I think there was at least one member of the 6th to the 11th Artillery, which was my unit, who's here in the audience today and can speak to that. The war was different war, but the situations are the same. One of the things that I note was that when I came home, coming, as we said, back to the world, there was no welcome home, no parades, and for a long time, nothing really understood or addressed about what Vietnam vets went through. As I say in Song Bateau, for too many of us, the war ended in futility, and that all our subsequent dreams of it only toll out our own despair of men weary, burnt out, rootless, often without hope, and strange to the generation that follow us. That's similar to a statement that Remarque made in All Quiet on the Western Front, and I drew a great sense of familiarity from that faraway war. I returned without wounds and began a career as a journalist and speechwriter, and now that I'm retired and have full time to devote to it, and a novelist. I thank my wife, Susan, who's here in the audience, for her great support and forbearance at what I have gone through. I know others who have not come back so well, who have become what we call tree vets, those who spend their days by themselves and their rare time in the company of others, staying only on the periphery, in the trees, they say, hiding from social contact. My good friend Tommy Skeans, who also served with Bravo Company 4-3, though at a different time, wrote a memoir called Buff Grunt, Memoirs of a Tree Vet, about such soldiers. And let me just finally say that we diligently honor our war dead with memorials aplenty just about everywhere you go. For Vietnam and the wars before and since, they just dot America. We remember those people as heroes and praise their service to the skies. But we owe at least as much to our wounded warriors to, as Lincoln said in his second inaugural, care for him, and I will add, and her, who shall have borne the battle. It's a trust we should never shirk. Thank you.
Now Michelle Wilmot.
Wow, this is a tough act to follow.
You can do it.
Well, my name is Michelle Wilmot, and thank you, Congresswoman Spire, and everybody here at the Commonwealth Club and guests. I definitely want to explain how this all really began. I graduated from Ensenal High School in Alameda, which is, of course, not too far away from here. And much to the disgust of my AP English and economics teacher, who said, please don't join the military, go to an art school, what are you doing? And I had come from a military family, so when I had gone to MEPS and actually enlisted in the military, I was 17 like Ari. So it was something that I had in my family already, because both sides of my family had served. I have an uncle who's a former Ranger. I have people on all sides of my family, women who've served in my family as well, in the Women's Army Corps. But it was something that it was looked at as vocation. I was living in Alameda. I didn't have any options. I got $2,000 offered to me for a staffer loan, but accepted into UC Berkeley, which was a little more than $2,000 for a semester. So my option was to go after the GI Bill, and the recruiter had a great game that he put out to me saying that, oh, you get $50,000 and for your education. So I figured, okay, well, I'll go to boot camp. I'll do whatever I need to do. I was very interested in psychology. It's something that I had always wanted to get into. But I got enlisted as both a medic and a mental health sergeant, or a mental health specialist. So I went, to the dismay of my teachers who wanted me to do more at the time. And I figured this was me doing more. I didn't join for baseball mom or apple pie. I did because I wanted to get out of my socioeconomic situation that was not going to allow me to go to school like everybody else. And I was seeing it more and more in movies and books and everything, that these people who are, going to four-year universities just wasn't me, even though I had wanted to. So I enlisted in the military, and I ended up going to Iraq in 2004. My intent was actually to serve as a medic and a mental health sergeant. I was in charge of the Ramadi Mental Health Clinic. And Ramadi is the capital of the Anbar province, which was one of the most dangerous provinces in Iraq. And some of you might remember the Battle of Fallujah, where around that time they hung the contractors from the bridge, and it was something that was really gruesome for the American public to see. But this was reality on the ground, that it was a reality that was very brutal, and Iraqis had to live this all the time. So this wasn't something that they could just walk away from either. But I had gone to Ramadi and ran the clinic, and I dealt with a command that prior to going to Iraq, I got switched to out of my current unit to another unit that was a unit out of Indianapolis, and it's the birthplace of the KKK for a reason, that state. But it was something that I'll never forget it, and one of the staff sergeants said, as soon as I walked into the door of my new unit, "Who's the raghead?" And I looked around, and I'm thinking, I know I'm ambiguously ethnic, so it's really hard for people to tell what I am, but I was thinking, really? Wow, the audacity for somebody to say something so hateful. And I looked at him, and I said, "Excuse me? Could you repeat that again?" And he's like, he went back to doing what he was doing, and he was standing around a bunch of other guys, and they blew it off. They didn't want the confrontation, even though they had, initiated contact. So that was the tone that I got when I first walked into the unit, and it only got worse. I originally just wanted to, not be checked on the radar at all. I just wanted to go about my business, finish out the deployment as quick as possible, and just go home. So even though a lot of my company got sent to Baghdad's Green Zone, which is, you might not be familiar with it, but if you ever seen the movie Green Zone with the pools and the palaces, that's true. So they got pools and palaces. I got sent out to Ramadi with the other people that they considered cannon fodder. And I did my time there. And it really felt like it was prison time. But it was something that I had actually enjoyed because the people I was with, both Iraqi interpreters, people in the city, and everybody else who I had to work with, the Marines were very professional that I worked with. They were great. But my command was stepping up the persecution of minorities in the company. They had eventually sent out a Jewish Italian colonel, which they were raking through the coals. Basically, any anti-Semitic, anti-Italian remark that you can make, they called her. And it was disgusting. She was a clinical psychologist, very well respected. Any human being shouldn't be treated that way, regardless of their credentials. So she got sent to Ramadi for a while, and we put our stories together, and we said, enough is enough. A lot of people have already tried to challenge the command, and they lost. But we were willing to go all the way. So we sat down, typed out our stories, and said, look, we're going to go to the judge advocate general and just say, okay, well, this is what we have. What can we do? So we actually took the proper steps to actually address the situation with the command. And it was, I'm really summarizing all that had happened. And it was just something that was very ridiculous. But we had put our stories together, and they said, okay, well, you have a bona fide case to relieve the command. They had waited for her to go on R&R, which is basically, 2 weeks to go outside the country. And they had tacked me for mutiny. I was trying to overthrow the command, and I belonged in jail. Leavenworth for you. You're worthless. Get out. So on the flight to face my mutiny charges, and mind you, everybody around me, all the Marines were, and everybody who knew me were just floored that this was happening. And they had actually handed me extra rounds and said, don't let them take you alive. And that was what I had to deal with. Unfortunately, I felt very alone, but fortunately, my helicopter didn't make it that night. I had made a pact with the universe, whatever you believe in, and I said, if you allow me to land in Baghdad tonight, I will make going to jail worth it. My helicopter, of course, didn't make it, and I had written about it in my book, Quixote and Ramadi. Much like Don Quixote, I went in very idealistic, thinking that I don't agree with this war, but I'm going to go and help out because I know people who are going to go over there like the bigots in my unit and are going to do damage. And I figured if I was there, I could do what I can. I can do my part to help people out. So my uncle, who was in Fallujah, who had tried to convince me not to join the army, he was ironically there, and I had told him what had happened. And he said, I understand. I totally get why you're this angry, and I would probably be thinking the same thing if I were in your position. But you have a lot of evidence. You have pictures. You have, you know, documentation about what had gone on. Spend your time here while you're trapped in Fallujah, because flights going in and out of Anbar province are not that frequent because of safety. And I had written, just based off of my journal excerpts, everything else compiled, 39 pages single-spaced. By the time I made it to Baghdad, I did what my uncle had asked. And he said, go ahead and take those 39 pages, make several copies, hide them in different places, place it on your commander's desk and say, if you're taking me down, I'm taking you with me. I know where MSNBC, all these other, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, I know which hotel they're staying at. Try me. Go ahead, proceed with mutiny. And they dropped it to an Article 15, disrespecting an officer, which is basically a slap in the wrist. So the saying, the pen is mightier than the sword, really did work out, because I was ready to totally bypass the pen and go for the rifle. So, and this was just something that I had been pushed into. I never thought about really hurting anybody in planning it until that point. And it was because I was pushed into a corner. I was made to feel like I was a thing and not a person. That you're not white, you must be an animal. Who cares about your life? And that was the message that was put upon me. But this is something that I grew up with. I'm biracial. My dad's side is Irish Catholic from Boston, and they were not a big fan of my Chamorro, which is a native of the Mariana Islands, my mother. They were not a big fan of interracial marriage. So they made that very, very clear while I was growing up. So that's what I write about, and what I also paint about is everything that I want to say that nobody just wanted to listen to. I don't have the typical rah, 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 I went to Iraq, here's a detailed glory, you know, glorious battle that I'm going to retell for you. And my story is about war is ugly. It's, you know, it's not something that's beautiful and painted and, you know, with cinematography and it's, you know, greatly scripted. It doesn't work like that at all. There are points where people are incredibly bored. Nobody even knows, like, half the time that I tell people it wasn't even Iraqis that we were fighting in Ramadi. And Ramadi was the training ground before they moved on to Fallujah and Baghdad. We were fighting, 85% of the people that we caught were Saudi. But we buy oil from them, so we're not going to really rat them out in the media, are we? So when people say, oh, what do you think? What can we do to end this conflict? I was like, let's stop, you know, let's switch to green energy. That's something that we can do to start. We need to really rethink our foreign policy. And this is not, to me, just, you know, three veterans and an elected official up here. This is about having a conversation. So this is not just us talking at you. This is an invitation to say, let's not repeat history. Let's actually learn from it, and then we can move on and be a society in which we can actually avoid war. That would be great. So I don't know if I'm going over time. Am I okay?
Yes,
okay. And just to wrap up, when I did come home, I dealt with racism in Iraq, but I dealt with the gender issue when I came back. Not too many people find women in combat very palatable. Whether you're for or against the war, it's aside the point. Coming from Chamorro culture, we're expected to be warriors. So in dealing with, you know, the hypervigilance, I tell people, you know, it's my culture to be vigilant. It's my culture to talk about things. We deal with death. We don't hide it away and just give people medication. We talk about it, and we celebrate those people. We don't just sit there and just say, oh, well, I don't want to hear about that. That's not the good part of the story I want to hear. I want to hear about the flag waving and the yellow ribbons and you know, the glorious aspects of war. And I say, no, let's talk about the ugly. Get it out. Let's stop numbing it down, and let's just process it. And that's all I got.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we are talking with combat veterans of Iraq and Vietnam who turned to art after coming home from war. All right, well, let's start that conversation now. These are some of the questions. How many of you still have flashbacks, and how do you deal with those experiences?
Anybody want to start?
That's an easy one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know I still have them. I know that my wife frequently complains that I'm hitting her in my sleep, that my dreams, which are a big part of the novel that I wrote, are still there. I think writing about them and getting that sort of catharsis is what helps me.
I mean, I have nightmares and flashbacks almost on a regular basis. Like, I remember once me and my wife were in a hotel and there was something on the news and an IED went off on the news. And I just flipped out and I just thought I was all the way back in Iraq again, calling in medevacs and just going crazy. So it's real. It's not just like some fake thing, like an excuse. It's actually a regular basis. You get triggered, you know, just this room of people is like, whoa, it's like too many people, you know. So it's, for myself, it's on a regular basis. You get triggered here and there.
The first few years, I could say, I was definitely a lot more, I don't want to say sensitive to it, but it was happening a little bit more often. But I forced myself to actually turn to writing it out, painting, doing something, and just keeping myself active. And it really took a matter of, continually trying to process that eventually over time it did die down, which I'm definitely grateful for. But I also have a wonderful fiance who is understanding and who has been very supportive. And he's also a veteran of Sarajevo in the Italian army. And usually when something comes on that could possibly be a trigger, he'll turn to me and ask right away, you know, are you all right? Is everything all right? Are you fine? So I think that constant, support has been very helpful in terms of assuaging any of the potential triggers.
Have any of the many veterans organizations been helpful to your reorientation, such as Wounded Warrior, Swords to Plowshares, etc.?
I'm interested now.
Don't ask.
I mean, I got out when I left the military. It was 2009, and I got my 10 days to clear, and I was on my way. I didn't even know there was such a thing as TBI. I didn't even know that here in Palo Alto they had the PTSD inpatient program. There was just how to write a resume. That's all the training I got, was how to write a resume and see ya. You know, so I didn't have any, I didn't hear from any kind of organization. And to be honest, I probably would have told them to get lost if I did. I was ready to just kind of get away from anything government related. I thought I've had enough time in my life with the government, time to kind of get a break.
Yeah, I have high praise for the VFW, which helped me to get disability benefits. I have type 2 diabetes, which is directly connected to Agent Orange, and they helped me move that claim. And I also have high praise for the Vietnam Veterans of America, who have lobbied a lot for benefits and for issues on our behalf.
I had an interesting experience with a couple of veterans organizations when I came back, and I actually did reach out, for example, to the IAVA, but got turned away. My issue was about race, and they didn't want to hear it, and boom, done. So I ended up hearing from a few organizations that came to my workplace. I was working for a veterans nonprofit at the time. And they had come to me and said, oh, do you just give these flyers to all the men that are here. You know, we want their membership. And I asked, oh, do you have any, you know, spaces open for women at all? And they said, oh, yeah, we have the Women's Auxiliary. And I said, oh, well, what do they do? And they said, oh, they bake cookies and raise money for the men. And I said, I don't want to bake cookies for the men. I want to be part of other, you know, a group of other veterans. I mean, I'm not looking to cook for you. I'm looking to talk. So they, of course, you know, looked at me like, you know, a deer in the headlights and said, oh, well, I guess you could join. Like, you know, my interest went from mild to not at all in a matter of a few seconds. But I hadn't had too many positive interactions with that. Actually, a few members of Vietnam Veterans of America had approached me after seeing Lioness. So Vietnam veterans have been very, very supportive, actually, in my return, as opposed to other Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, unfortunately. But it was something that it's definitely changing. The Veterans Art Program reached out, and there are a couple of that here and there that are creative-based that have reached out to me just recently. So that's been my experience.
So how has your art helped you in your recovery? Michelle, why don't you talk about the piece that you have on display in here?
Oh, well, this piece is called Papers, Please, and it's a painting I did of Sitting Bull, and it's in response to SB 1070 in Arizona. I used to live in Arizona, and I thought the anti-immigration legislation was ridiculous. And I used to hear, oh, well, things need to go back to the way they used to be and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what, Native American? Like, are we going to really do that? Okay, great. But I did that in response to a lot of the bigoted remarks I was hearing about, you know, everybody who is not Caucasian needs to just get out. So I thought, okay, well, let's really have a conversation about legitimacy and imperialism. Okay, so I did this painting with Sitting Bull asking for your papers. So... just a little tongue-in-cheek, right back at the people.
All right. Ari?
My painting's over here. I mean, it's my version of an American flag, you know, with all the bullets all over it and all the skulls for the stars. And if you look in there, it's two different kinds of skulls. There's one of dead people and one of people that just look shell-shocked. Like, those are the cost of our desire to be, like, the biggest, baddest bully on the block has caused so many deaths and so many problems for people. You know, not just, sometimes I think I should have died there because it probably would have been easier than going through what I'm going through now. You know, that's often a lot of times what I think, that it's actually easier if I would have died, because then, you know, I wouldn't have to go on reliving these things over and over and over again.
You know, in talking to many veterans, what I here is the interest in redeploying had more to do with the fact that they couldn't come back into society and reengage, so they wanted to go back into the war and the front, because there they could interact. There they knew how to be. Is that common?
let me see. I was in Iraq from 2003 to 2008, basically. I started to think that was my home and that the United States was my deployment. Like, I could remember my military mailing address, but I couldn't remember my home of records address anymore. I started to really think that this is where I belong, that going to the U.S. for me is like a combat deployment, and that's just everyday life. I mean, that's pretty intense when you get that feeling like this is the only place where you belong. I mean, even, what was it, last year I was thinking of joining the French Foreign Legion because I was like, well, it seems I can only fit into war. I can't function outside of it. And I was really kind of going with it like, okay, maybe that's the thing to do. So, yeah, you become more, I guess, conditioned to war than you do mm-hmm. to civilian world. Like, I don't understand this whole thing in the civilian world, relationships, and, like, it just makes no sense to me. But if you give me a convoy, a map, a plugger, I'm there, you know? But if you ask me to talk to somebody, nope, that's not going to happen.
Drew, how about you?
You know, I served one tour in Vietnam. I served with plenty of guys that served two and even three tours there. It is impossible for me to understand how they could handle it. I was there... Our tours were long. I was there for a year. And in that time, the stress, I was there at kind of the height of the war, so there was ugly stuff all the time. And I came back. I got a free steak dinner at Fort Lewis, Washington. I signed out. I got a plane trip home. And I had less than no interest in going back. Shortly after I got back, the Army did a study of morale problems among junior officers like me. I was a first lieutenant when I was in Vietnam. And they found that morale among junior officers was as bad as it had been at any time that anyone had researched in the United States Army because of the poor treatment, because of a war that people did not like, because of a huge split among the American people as to the validity of the war and such. And I think that if it had been a different war at a different time, I might have thought about it, but my interest was zero.
I'd just like to add one thing, because it's hard if you don't have, if you've never been to it, it's kind of hard to explain. Just picture my last deployment. I arrived in Iraq in 2006, and when I left, it was 2008. Just to kind of give you a concept of time. 2 years is a long time. You know, I came back, there were iPhones. Wow, those were like, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, like, really, 2 years of your life spent in a war zone. I mean, and to give you an idea of how that affects the psyche so much, that's 2 years of your life. You come home, your kids are doing all kinds of crazy things, and the world has changed.
What is the most important lesson you gained after serving in the military, and what drives you to move forward in your new life chapter?
I can definitely say that after experiencing what I did in Iraq, and it wasn't combat that got to me the most and caused any post-traumatic stress, it was dealing with rampant bigotry, and that was my big trigger. So the lesson I took from that, even in considering redeploying, I wouldn't have minded if it were just for the purpose of combat. I would have minded if I had to deal with a unit like that again, and that ended my enlistment. They had offered me $30,000 to stay in as a medic, and I said, I don't care if it's a million, keep it. I have no interest at all in staying because of this. I saw no justice, and I came back home completely broken. And the biggest lesson I took from that is just to keep going and never stop talking about it. Even when people don't want to hear, find different ways and, you know, different means around it, which is why I turned to art and why I turned to writing. I know not everybody's going to want to read my book because they might think on one side, oh, just another war book, or on the other side, they're just not interested at all in hearing a story about that doesn't glorify war or make it look like some, you know, patriotic story. To keep going and to keep surviving, and that no matter how much that we all might, you know, question life and not feel it's worth it anymore, nothing's going to change unless we keep pushing for change. So I think that's the biggest lesson, is just to keep going.
Yeah, I think the thing that I learned more than anything else was that you are nothing alone, that everyone needs close friends who have your back at all times. And I never find itself truer than all these years later when I go to reunions of fellows I served with in Vietnam, and the sense of immediate connection and camaraderie and, oh, do you remember this? Oh, do you remember that? Is a sense that we went through something so powerful that even all these years and thousands of miles apart, we still trust each other implicitly.
I mean, I'm from the East Coast. I'm just too stubborn to stop, to give up. You know, that's just it. You know, I'm just too stubborn. You know, that's it. I mean, how nowadays I just think, well, let me try and make a difference in the world by just painting. And I'm not Rembrandt or any of these guys. You know, I just use that as a means for every day, trying to kind of educate people about what I went through without them having to go through it. And just each day you get a little victory to be able to go on to the next day. You know, I've come a long way since getting out of the military. I've become, you know, more honest in my life, more honest to myself, and able to open up to people. And I guess those things are helping me just get by each day, because I don't plan for the future. I just take it day by day, because that's all I can take it. Anything, you know, like, it's just like a basic rifle marksmanship. You know, you have the 25 meter, and then you have the 50, and then you have the 75, and you know, you got to get what's right, what's in front of you first before you go to the last guy, the immediate threat. And so for me, that's what it is. Just the stupidity or stubbornness, and just wanting a better life.
This is actually a question, I think, for me, but I'd like to toss it to all of you. Is there any discussion, movement in Congress to reinstate a selective service bill to share the sacrifice? There is one bill by Charlie Rangel of New York to reinstate universal conscription. The likelihood of it moving very far is not great. But let's talk about that, because when I was a youngster, Vietnam was on the TV every single night. And it was because everyone had a loved one that was engaged. That's not the case today. So what are your views about universal conscription or selective service?
I am a strong proponent of it. I believe that the reason that Vietnam became such a powerful debate in this country was exactly that. Everyone had something in the game to deal with. I have vast respect for those who serve, who volunteer, who serve today when they do not have to. But at the same time, I think that having a draft which requires everyone to serve, to understand the commitment that you made to the fact that you may need to lay your life on the line for this country is something that we have lost because we have an all-volunteer service. And I would very much love to see that reinstated.
In Germany, you either join the Bundeswehr or you do some community service or something. And so therefore, there's some sense of sacrifice there among the people, right? And I think a selective service should be like that. In many countries, if you go to Europe, and I know how we don't like to throw Europe around and we don't want to be like them, but if you see in those countries, they either you have to go to school, you have to go to university, or you have to go to the military, or you have to do some kind of social service. And I do think that should be required. I do think that if more people experience that sacrifice, whether it's in the military or something, just giving up a little piece of their life, I think then that we'd be a lot quicker to say, well, let's not invade this country. You know, let's kind of chill out and just stay at home for a while. That's what I think.
Well, I'm not a big fan of using military action in place of foreign policy. I think if we counted maybe the 1%, the children of elected officials who are making these decisions, if as long as they were included, I would be for it, because we wouldn't even be engaging in these conflicts if their kids were included. So that's the only way I'd be okay with it.
This one references a book called Go to War by Carl Marklidis. And he talks about the need for veterans to have an organized means to discuss the long-term impacts of trauma and combat. Can you discuss what you think is needed to help veterans re-enter civilian life and how community members can help the re-entry process?
Well, I think for one, aside from teaching people how to write resumes, and even though I deal with resumes as part of my profession right now, I actually do write resumes for people in Las Vegas, which is like the Detroit of the West, and it is. But so I ended up getting people jobs, but these are great to have to get your foot in the door for a place of employment, not for everyday positive coping mechanisms. So it's not that everybody in the community or just mental health professionals need to have an answer. It's about validating people's experiences, listening. You don't have to have the answer for somebody. You just need to be there. You just need to be supportive. They'll tell you when they're ready. And it's not something to be forced. It's not something that anybody's entitled to. It's somebody's own experience, and let them deal with it. Let them exist. And I think Ari touched some really good points on that in terms of coming back and feeling that, you know, I was trained to operate in this environment, but I'm told this is not okay when I'm coming back home. Because the general American public seems so detached from what veterans go through nowadays, I think there's definitely a need to bridge that gap and provide more understanding. I think having panel discussions just like this help. Having some kind of conversation with not just government officials or just a few select members of the community. This is just a great way to start the healing process and, of course, avoid conflicts like this to begin with.
Okay, we're running short on time, so I want to give you each an opportunity to make one final statement. There are continuing concerns about how can we be helpful? What volunteer organizations should we sign up for? How can we in the community help you re-engage? So, maybe a final minute from each of you.
Oh, I go first? Oh.
Michael Moore wrote a great article. You know, he was saying that supporting the troops is not just having a little yellow flag, right? And he goes on in this article saying supporting the troops is going to the VA hospital, you know, and volunteering some time. Supporting the troops is that if a veteran comes in offering a veteran's discount, you'd be so surprised how little people actually offer a veteran discount. A lot of times, I went on Veterans Day once to a store to go in. I said, well, what about the veteran's discount? And she said, well, it's Veterans Day. What more discount do you want? You know? So, yeah. I think just more common sense and more willingness to actually listen to us.
Okay, true.
You know, I think it's because we're having the wrong conversation. I think the conversation today seems to be about we support our troops because we believe that they are those who are standing in between us and the dangers of the world. And I think the problem with that is that it becomes very political. It becomes, if you like this war, then you're going to support the troops. If you dislike this war, you think, well, I have to support the troops because they're ours, but I don't like the war, and I'm really angry at them for serving. I can recall in Vietnam, you know, the questions were raised as, well, you know, I was a war protester in Berkeley before I went into the Vietnam War. Why didn't I go to Canada? Well, I'm an American. I want to stay in this country and be part of it, and I want to be part of it despite my participation in a war people didn't like. And I think that as long as it becomes a political issue rather than a sociological one, that we don't have any real solutions for it.
Thank you. Michelle.
I think Drew's definitely right about it being a sociological issue than just a political one. It's not just about volunteering with Wounded Warrior Project or any of those, you know, the myriad nonprofits out there that are looking to help out veterans, pack up candy and everything like that. It's not about flag waving. It's not about thank you for your service. It's not just about that. This is about not being complacent. And the last thing that I remember above all else in seeing in theater was complacency kills. Signs everywhere saying complacency kills. Complacency to what's going on in the world. Complacency to what's going on in this country. Complacency to what's going on with the person next to you. That's our problem, is complacency, and we need to stop that.
Yeah.
I think a common theme has been how easy it is to be detached. And by your presence here today, you have shown that you want to be attached. So we thank you all. Our special thanks to Michelle Wilmot, Iraqi war veteran, artist, and writer, to Drew Mendelson, Vietnam War veteran and writer, and Ari Sonnenberg, Iraqi war veteran and artist. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, TV, and the internet. This program has been part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also want to remind you that the artwork by our panelists, Michelle and Ari, are on display outside this room, and copies of the books by Michelle and Drew Mendelson will be on sale, and they will be pleased to sign them after the program. I'm Congresswoman Jackie Speier, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.